And it's time for another edition of Rockin' the Boat. My name is the V-Man, and you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. On today's program, we're going to be discussing an altogether uncomfortable topic, childhood sexual abuse, in the wake of a Supreme Court decision which essentially erases statutes, retroactive statutes of limitation for the prosecution of perpetrators of childhood sexual abuse. I'll be joined by Beth Love, Executive Director of the Survivors Healing Center, a nonprofit organization providing education, information, referrals, and other services to victims and survivors of childhood sexual abuse and their supporters. Stand by, stay tuned for Rockin' the Boat, coming up next. As I mentioned, today we'll be discussing childhood sexual abuse. Unfortunately, sexual abuse of children happens at an alarming rate, and all too often in this society, there is a fear of dealing openly with this problem. Today, I'm joined in the studio by Beth Love. She is the executive director of the Survivors Healing Center, a nonprofit organization which provides education, information, referrals, high-quality services, and support to survivors of childhood sexual abuse and their supporters. Beth Love is a graduate of UC Santa Cruz and holds a degree in community studies with a focus on child abuse prevention. She has been in active recovery from child sexual abuse since 1988. Today, we'll talk openly about sexual abuse and the trauma it can cause. We'll also be examining a recent Supreme Court decision which limits the criminal prosecution of perpetrators of sexual abuse of children. Beth Love, I want to welcome you to the studio.
Hi, thanks, Mr. V.
Why don't we begin by having you talk as much or as little as you want about your own personal experiences and to whatever extent you feel comfortable telling us your story.
Okay. Well, I'm always very comfortable to share. I think it's really important that people who feel moved to and feel comfortable sharing about their experience being sexually abused do so, because it's a subject that we don't talk about enough. And talking about it is a first step toward eradicating it, because at this point, it's a very uncomfortable topic, and it's a taboo to talk about, though unfortunately not to do. As Vinnie mentioned, it's child sexual abuse happens in alarming proportions. So I was sexually abused for many, many years during my childhood and well into my adulthood by the man that had married my mother, my stepfather. And my sister was also sexually abused by the same man. We were also subject to physical, emotional, and spiritual harm in our family, as well as neglect. And it had a great effect on me, and I, in fact, shaped my life and my responses around it, creating many different coping mechanisms to try to take care of myself and get my needs met. And those coping mechanisms were really wonderful as survival strategies when I was a child, and I think very creative. But unfortunately, like many survivors, I did carry them into my adulthood. Most forms of child abuse, period, does not get reported to the authorities at the time it's happening. And so, like most children, I continued to suffer in silence and to figure out ways to get around it, carrying a huge emotional and psychological burden into my adulthood. So it's hard to say my story in just a few minutes, and I don't think that's the most important part, but the abuse in our family was substantial. My sister and I were both impregnated in our teens. We both bore children by our stepfather, and that has had continuing scars into the next generation, as you might well imagine, given that those children are the products of incest. I did get into recovery in 1988, and it's been really a long road, a lot of work. Essentially, when we are children and we cope with what's happening, we find ways to keep ourselves from feeling the full impact. So it might be, use of substances. It might be self-mutilation. It might be caretaking behavior. It might be perfectionism. There's many different ways that children cope. However, at some point, if we are going to recover, we do need to feel all the feelings, and we do need to, face the depths of despair that we felt as children who were being betrayed so terribly at the hands, generally, of someone who was charged with protecting us and caring for us.
And maybe you can address it at some point in maybe from your own personal experiences, but also generally what survivors, or I'm still not comfortable with that term, but that's the preferred term, I suppose, what survivors kind of go through in coming to terms with what happened to them, and what sorts of resources are available in our society.
Okay. Well, I'll be happy to address that. I'd like to first address the topic of the word survivors. Many people feel really empowered by calling themselves survivors rather than victims. And my perspective, and this may be just me personally, though I know there are other people that have thought about such things. From my perspective, we've all been survivors, that the victims are the ones that died. And that because as children, most of us are able to find ways to survive and to cope, that we are survivors. We know how to survive. We know how to survive very well. But what I want for myself and for other survivors is to move beyond and to find ways to live that feel more free and more hopeful and come from a place of choice and joy and a pleasure and not just always be in survival mode. But it is a term that for many people is empowering. So, in terms of what people have to deal with, many times there's layers of other types of addictions that are on top that will definitely have to be dealt with. It's very common for survivors to medicate in some way to deal with the pain. So it might be substance abuse, it might be eating disorders, it might be workaholism. It might be finding different ways to dissociate. The extreme end of dissociation would be to split off different personalities, formerly known as multiple personality disorder. But most of us find some way to split off a part of ourselves, to separate ourselves from that wounded child part. So those things need to be dealt with. There's also a matter of learning new coping mechanisms over time that are more healthy to replace the ones that we were using, and eventually to learn skills that are beyond coping. So we might need to learn to take good care of ourselves. That's really very common, just learning basic self-care, you know, learning to go to the bathroom when we need to go to the bathroom, learning to ask for help, learning to ask for support, learning to pay attention to our body's cues. You know, we for the most part have been raised in environments where we were taught not to pay attention to our body's cues. We were told in many ways, sometimes directly and sometimes in less direct ways, that our needs were not important and we didn't need to get our needs met. So it's a whole process of reteaching ourselves what our needs are and that they are important and how to get those needs met. So it can be very basic. It's critical that survivors find a support system when they're in recovery. Some people find support in one relationship with a therapist. That's a fairly common route. There are other survivors that choose a peer support group, like Survivors of Incest Anonymous. There are other survivors that might choose to be in a therapy group. Many survivors have a more informal support network. I always encourage people to have a very diverse and broad support network, to have people that you can turn to at any time, day or night, because usually during recovery there are periods when you need someone right in the middle of the night. So a support network is critical. And many people will use different therapeutic modalities. People will use body work. They'll use somatics. They'll use acupuncture. They'll use spirituality is very big, prayer, meditation, finding some kind of spiritual source. And for many people, they were abused in the context of a religion or of a spiritual path. And so for those people, reclaiming a spiritual source that's different and that's good and that's healing is important.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name is the V-Man, and this is Rockin' the Boat, coming to you each weekday, Monday through Friday, from 5:30 to 6. I'm joined live in the studio today by Beth Love. She's the Executive Director of Survivors Healing Center in Santa Cruz. Maybe we can talk a bit about the center and then get into some of the specifics about the Supreme Court decision of last month affecting the prosecution of perpetrators. Survivors Healing Center is sort of unique in this area. Is that right? It's sort of like a one-of-a-kind space for childhood sexual abuse survivors?
That's right. It's one-of-a-kind in this area, and it's also fairly unique within the country and the world. We do get calls from people all over the country and sometimes from other countries saying that they don't have anything like us in their area and what can we do for them. So there aren't many organizations that are dedicated to supporting survivors of child sexual abuse, especially when we're talking about adult survivors. There do tend to be more services available for children, though not enough of that as well.
And why is it, do you think, that that is? That there's more services out there for younger people than there are for adults who may be first coming to realize that they were abused as children?
I think that we have a long way to go as a culture to get over, you know, our denial. I mean, this topic has only been talked about for a very short time. And historically, each time child sexual abuse has come to the forefront as an issue that society needs to deal with, it has gone underground again. A classic example is Freud, when he found that almost all of his female patients were telling stories of being sexually abused by their, or used sexually by their fathers. He started reporting this, and he believed at first that it was the basis for a disease that many women had at the time that they called hysteria, which is named after a uterus. I mean, doesn't that tell you something? But he published a paper, and he was shunned by colleagues, and the society was not really ready to accept this. And so he reversed his ideas, and he decided instead that women fantasized about being sexual with their fathers. So this has happened time and time again, and it really is only in the last three decades or so that we have openly talked about it. So for starters, nobody believes that it happens. Nobody believes that it happens in the numbers that it happens or to the degree to which it happens. For instance, people have a very hard time accepting that very young infants are sexually abused, are penetrated with objects, with penises. People have a very hard time accepting the whole scope of it. And then on top of that, we have this idea that once someone's an adult, they should just get over it. And so there's not a very full understanding of the long-lasting ramifications well into adulthood. And for most survivors, they find ways to cope. I would say the vast majority of people who are sexually abused in their childhood never get into recovery and never seek help. So it is an issue that we're still in our infancy with in terms of dealing with it.
And maybe what are the numbers nationally? How many cases are reported each year of children being sexually abused or sexually, touched in inappropriate ways or something?
Well, I don't like to talk too much about the reports. I'll tell you what I know. There's a study called the National Incidence Study, and it goes further than the reports. It still doesn't give us a true picture, but it's better than the reported cases. We know that all forms of child abuse are very underreported, highly, highly underreported. And so the truth is that we can't tell you the exact incidents because we don't know. But the National Incidence Study goes further than reported cases. It also interviews law enforcement personnel, teachers, social workers, people like that work with children, and it tries to get an estimate of the true picture. And in the last year that the National Incidence Study was taken, it's not taken every year, I believe it was late 90s, they found over 300,000 cases nationwide, which is pretty alarming. And that's just for sexual abuse. But when you compare it to the statistics that we have from studies of adults who are reporting retrospectively, so looking back over their lifetime and then saying what happened to them, there's a great variety in what you get in those studies, depending on what kinds of questions were asked, what population was asked, et cetera. But it's the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has looked at a large number of those studies and has weeded out those that they think were not done well, and comes to the conclusion that as many as 1 in 3 females and as many as 1 in 7 males are sexually abused by the age of 18. So as you can see, it's epidemic. It's larger than breast cancer. It's larger than AIDS.
Again, we're speaking with Beth Love. She's the Executive Director of Survivors Healing Center in Santa Cruz. Let's talk a little bit about the specifics of the Supreme Court ruling. On June 26th, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that the government could not erase statutes of limitations retroactively. Maybe you can explain what this Supreme Court decided on and who it affects.
Okay. The California legislature passed a new statute for child sexual abuse in 1994, recognizing the fact that most children do not report the abuse and that most adults do not report initially, and that it takes many years for someone to get some recovery under their belt before they really feel strong enough and courageous enough to take on someone who was victimizing them when they were children and powerless. They decided that in the most substantial cases of child sexual abuse, that they wanted to treat it more like murder. There is no statute of limitations in murder. And they wanted to recognize the devastating effects of child sexual abuse. And so they essentially created a very good statute, I believe, which in certain cases of child sexual abuse erased the statute entirely if certain conditions were met. So this only applied to what they called substantial child sexual abuse, and they define that to be sexual intercourse with a child, masturbation, oral sex, that type of thing. And it only applied to cases which had never come to the attention of law enforcement before. And it only applied to cases in which there was some type of corroborating evidence. It might be testimony from some other child who had been sexually abused or diary entries, some type of corroborating evidence. And they said if all those conditions were met, then a report could be filed even if the abuse had happened decades ago, and that the police would have 1 year to investigate and to file formal charges. So under that statute, approximately 800 child sexual abuse perpetrators have been imprisoned in the state of California, and it has given survivors a tool of empowerment and also, more importantly, a way to get perpetrators off the street and little children safe, though I like to address that more. I mean, they're not safe because there's lots of perpetrators out there, but known perpetrators, it gives a tool for putting in prison the worst, the known perpetrators. So, at the time of that statute of limitations, there had been a 6-year statute of limitations on those same types of sexual abuse within the state of California. So the portion of the law that the Supreme Court struck was the part that applied it retroactively to cases that would have already had their statutes expired at the time that the 1994 law was passed.
And do we know how many cases that may be, what the numbers are?
Well, the ones that were already in prison that had been tried and convicted and imprisoned was 800. And they now have to go through all of those cases because in some of those cases, they had been sexually abusing children over many, many years. And some of the cases were after 1988 when the statute still applies to any cases after 88. And some of them happened before 1988. So they have to go through all of those cases. And in some cases, they'll have to have new sentencing hearings and give them shorter sentences.
Wow.
Some of them will be let out completely. Many.
Completely let out.
Completely
like
let
just,
out.
Here you go. You're free. Sorry.
Free. Sorry. They won't even be registered sex offenders. And in many cases, they had pled guilty to the crimes. And then that's just a small part of it, the 800 cases. There are also many, many cases that were pending. And I don't know the numbers on that, but I know that there were many, many cases that were pending that have, for the most part, been thrown out.
And you yourself, one of your sister has a case pending against your stepfather?
And that's until the Supreme Court decision.
And now that's no longer happening in the courts. That's been nullified.
That's correct.
As a result of the Supreme Court decision.
Right. I don't personally believe that prison is the answer by any means. I believe that it's a last resort, and I would like to see adults within the children's networks protecting children and confronting perpetrators. And I do believe it's a mental health issue, and that I'd rather see perpetrators who are willing and who will benefit by treatment get treatment. But it is a very important tool. And we had tried working within our own family to try to get all the adults involved to protect the children from the known perpetrator. And when all those attempts failed, that's when we turned to the law.
Mm-hmm. I see. And it seems to me, though, from what you've described, that it's really kind of set up to help out perpetrators rather than to help out the victims or survivors. Is that the case? I mean, generally speaking, is that how you see it? That the criminal justice system sort of has the deck stacked against the child or the adult who has been abused as a child?
I think that the recent Supreme Court decision striking the retroactive portions does indeed rule in favor of perpetrators. I don't believe that it's a criminal justice. Believe me, I don't like the criminal justice system. I believe it to be racist. And, you know, most people in there are drug addicts, and that's why they're in there. But I don't believe that the problem with the continued perpetuation of child sexual abuse and the growing numbers is a failure of the criminal justice system. I do believe that justice is not applied fairly within the criminal justice system on this issue. I was kind of following the Catholic Church thing, mm-hmm. and I noticed that there seemed to be some kind of homophobic tendencies yeah. that the priests that were accused of molesting boys were getting were having their bail set at much higher numbers and were getting longer sentences. It seems to be kind of acceptable to use girls this way in our culture. I also have noticed that what comes to the attention of media and law enforcement is more typically stranger abuse or fairly removed abuse, whereas the most common type of abuse is familial abuse. Most children who are abused, by far the vast majority, are abused by someone they know and that they know well. And very, very, very often it is someone in their immediate family. You rarely see those cases come to trial. You rarely see those cases appear in the media.
And is that maybe due to sort of some intimidating factors, for the child, you know, going up against a respected adult that they may love very much and care about? And I know it's kind of general, but can you give us an idea of typically what happens in that situation?
I don't know if there's a typical, yeah. but, you know, if you imagine yourself as a child who's dependent, entirely dependent on this person who is abusing you, you will understand the forces against going and telling anybody. And that's the reason that I think that we really need to be looking for prevention, for solutions that are really preventative in nature, for ways to support families before they get in big trouble like this. Mm-hmm. Some perpetrators, some pedophiles, I'm not by any stretch of the imagination an expert on pedophiles, but I know that some people are classified as true pedophiles and some people are more situational. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, my stepfather, I think if there had been intervention much earlier in my family, then there would have been some red flags that would have raised somebody's attention and my family would have gotten some support and some services that would have prevented it from escalating to the point that it did.
What do you think those are, those red flags? What should people look for?
Well, there's unfortunately, this is an area that needs a lot more study. I focused on child abuse prevention at school, and we've done a lot of studying about risk factors for physical child abuse and for neglect, but there's been very little studying for risk factors for sexual abuse. We do know that that child sexual abuse happens in dysfunctional families, so we can use some of the indicators that are used for the other forms of abuse to pick out some families that might be in trouble. So, for instance, if there are families that are having problems with drug and or alcohol abuse, that's something that would indicate that they need some help, they need some support. If there's families where the parents themselves were raised in abusive environments, they don't necessarily have the parenting skills that they need.
Looks like we have a call coming in. I'm going to go ahead and bring the caller on. Yes. Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Oh, Vinny.
Yes. You're on the air.
Oh.
We're talking about childhood sexual abuse. Do you have a question for my guest?
No, I wish you luck.
Thank you.
We need a lot of luck with this subject.
we do have a few moments left, and if there is anybody in the listening audience who would like to address the issue we're talking about today and ask a question of my guest, Beth Love, the number in the studio is 427-3772. We have another call coming in. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to ask your guest I'm sure she's aware of the principle. I don't know that all child abusers are abused children, and I wondered what she thinks of that. If she basically would agree with that, or
okay. Thanks for your call. Do you think that all people who have been abused as children end up being perpetrators themselves?
Okay, so I understood the caller's question a little differently. He asked if all perpetrators had been abused.
Oh, okay.
And the answer is no. All perpetrators have not been sexually abused, though the majority have been. There's still, as I said, we're new at this, so there are conflicting studies and there are new ones coming out. But it appears that many, many perpetrators of child sexual abuse were sexually abused in their childhood. But the converse is not true. Most people who were sexually abused do do not grow up to become perpetrators, and I think that's really important. I've heard of cases where people have been discriminated against because they're survivors, and so people are afraid to trust them with children. The vast majority of people who are sexually abused do not go on to abuse. However, sadly, because I believe because we don't get the tools that we need in our families of origins to be really good parents, typically, we our children are at risk, and studies bear up that the children of people who are sexually abused in their childhood are at an increased risk of themselves being sexually abused by someone during their childhoods. So I believe that the answer is for the parents to get into recovery and do their own healing work, because when we become healthier ourselves, we can be better able to spot appropriate boundaries and spot boundary violations and protect our children better and be more present for them.
And you're tuned to Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. We have just a few moments left, and maybe we can just kind of wrap up on some information about the Survivors Healing Center. Where can people check that out? And ultimately, I think what we all want to see here is that the abuse to stop, you know, that no other child go through childhood sexual abuse. And that's the end goal. And how we get there really is a moot point, in my opinion. And I don't know, maybe you can address that.
Okay. So for starters, if people are interested in getting a hold of Survivors Healing Center for services or to lend us some support or to give us a donation, it's Survivors Healing Center, and we have two offices. In Santa Cruz, we're at 2301 Mission Street, Suite C1, and we're open Tuesdays through Thursdays, 10 to 5. In Watsonville, we're at 406 Main Street, and we're open on Wednesdays all day, 9 to 5, and then Friday in the morning, 9 to 12. And the phone number is 831-423-7601. You can also email me at beth@survivorshealingcenter.org, all spelled out. So I think that talking about is important. There are many things we can do, and I do have a handout, actually. If people are interested, I can mail them or email them some information about how they can help. There's another organization I want to give a little plug to, Generation 5. You can find them at www.generation5, spelled out, FIVE.org. And their mission is to end child sexual abuse in 5 generations. So if people are moved to take action, that would be another really good organization to contact, because they need activists.
Maybe in one thought that just kind of came up, if there's anybody in our audience who happens to be listening who is currently perpetrating against a child, what would you say to that person? How would you get them to stop doing what they're doing?
I would ask them to try to understand how very, very harmful it is, that it is something that impacts people very severely over a lifetime. And your courage in stopping can help a child. And even if you end up, you know, turning yourself in and going to prison, it's going to be better for you and everybody overall. You know, I think you'll feel better about yourself. There are perpetrators who have turned themselves in. There are perpetrators who have gotten into recovery, gotten help. And though you have a large shame load to deal with, I would just encourage you to stop. That's the most important thing. Adults need to stop the abuse.
And that's going to wrap it up here for us tonight on Rockin' the Boat. My guest has been Beth Love. She is the executive director of the Survivors Healing Center, located at, again, what's the address?
2301 Mission Street in Santa Cruz.
At 2301 Mission in Santa Cruz. And that's open 9 to 5, Monday through Friday?
No, 10 to 5, Tuesday through Thursday.
Oh, sorry.
I wish we had that much staff.
And you can find out also more info on their website, www.survivorshealingcenter.org. Tune in again tomorrow at 5:30 to 6 o'clock for another edition of Rockin' the Boat.
Incest.
It's like screaming, but hearing no echo.
Survivors of Incest Anonymous, a 12-step self-help recovery program, can supply echoes.
Survivors of Incest Anonymous provides support groups,
literature,
newsletters,
pen pals,
and speakers
There are no dues or fees, and Survivors of Incest Anonymous define incest very broadly to include any sexual encounter by a family member, an extended family member, or any adult that damaged the child.
Recovery is difficult, but at least now, survivors can learn that they are no longer alone and not to blame.
Healing is possible.
In Santa Cruz County, there are 3 Survivors of Incest Anonymous meetings each week. The women's group meets on Mondays from 6 p.m. until 7:30 p.m. The women's group meets the first and third Monday of each month in Soquel at the Porter Memorial Library located at 3050 Porter Street, and the second and fourth Monday of each month in Santa Cruz at Survivors Healing Center located at 2301 Mission Street, Suite C1, behind China Station.
The men's group meets on Tuesdays from 7:30 p.m. until 9 p.m. The men's group meets each week in Santa Cruz at Survivors Healing Center, located at 2301 Mission Street, Suite C1, behind China Station.
A third group, open to any childhood sexual abuse survivor, meets on Sundays from 7:30 p.m. until 9 p.m. in downtown Santa Cruz at the Walnut Avenue Women's Center, located at the corner of Walnut and Chestnut Streets.
These meetings are all fragrance-free and open only to incest survivors and their supporters.
For more information about Survivors of Incest Anonymous, call 831-477-4165.
That's 831-477-4165. Or visit Survivors of Incest Anonymous online at www.siawso.org.
That's www.siawso.org.